So hi, good evening. I am so glad we are going to talk about social justice tonight. I don't know why it gets such a bad rap, and at the same time, I am scared to death about talking about social justice because people really take this stuff seriously. And you can step on toes or create harm and difficulty just in the way that you talk about social justice, about whether or not you talk about it in a way that fits into the mold of what each one of us in this room thinks about it. So, saying that, I'm going to put out some assumptions first, so we kind of get the lay of the land. First of all, I think whenever you talk about equanimity, social justice comes up. And it comes up because I think there is a distinction between the mind's view of equanimity and practice view of equanimity, which is pretty much what we talked about all month. So it's only natural that as soon as we start talking about how can we be peaceful, how can we be balanced and still, that the mind is going to think, do you know what world we're living in here now? How in the world could we be balanced and still in the world on fire as it is? And so I think it's natural for us to have concerns around social justice when we talk about equanimity and talking about it with practice. So to have a conversation specifically pointed in this direction is actually more in line with being real with the practice rather than trying to avoid where that pain is. The second assumption is that I want to kind of make sure we're in the same group. Some people practice all the time. In fact, that's all they do is their practice. They do their Dhamma. They don't get involved with the world. They do their Dhamma. They're in caves or they're in monasteries or, you know, they're just practitioners that are lay practitioners, but all they do is their practice, and that's it. There are some people who are only activists. So all they do is activist work. They don't do all the Dhamma, meditation, Buddhist. They're not Buddhist. They're not Christians. They're not none of that. They just do activism, and they're out there in the world doing their activism. And then there's a third group that kind of is in the middle here doing activism, social justice actions, and practicing at the same time. And my assumption is that's the group we're talking to. That's the group we're in. We're in that kind of middle section. And that somehow this talk is about how do we both do our activism and practice at the same time, and that we're not solely activists and we're not solely practitioners. That's the group I'm kind of pointing to. The third kind of assumption I'm holding everything in is that given that we are practitioners who are working in this area of social justice, we cannot or we are not trying to live in the end result. We're trying to live in the whatever present moment that happens to be around our work, whatever that is. So we are not trying to fix a problem. We're trying to be with it, be with whatever is going on. And we'll talk a little bit more about that one. But The fourth one is that I believe there will forever be a need for social justice. So it's tied to this idea that we are practicing and being and working in the area of social justice in a world that, or in an existence, a human existence, that will always require some kind of social justice work. And so the idea that we are working and practicing within this goes along with this idea that we're working in the moment with whatever is arising. And then finally, whatever efforts we do in this area is all held within the Eightfold Path. It's all a part of our path, and the Eightfold Path as we travel through. So whatever we do, whatever actions we talk about, or however we hold this, we hold it within the path of the, within that Eightfold Path. So right view, right intention, the wisdom side of it, the action side being right action, right effort, right energy, right action, right livelihood. So right effort, energy, right action, right livelihood. And then, right concentration, right mindfulness. And, there's one more. That's it. It's the speech that always gets me. It always gets me. So that's up in the action part. That's right. I always forget that it has both part of the precepts and its separate category. I guess the Buddha was like serious about speech. So that we're holding everything we do within the framework of how do we practice with this as part of our practice and be with the situations. So that's pretty much what I want to, that's the framework I want to frame this kind of little talk in about. And, I'm going to keep the same three kind of ways that we talked about practicing last week, because I do think that equanimity is already present with us all the time. As practitioners, the fact that we practice equanimity is a result of that practice, and that what hinders us or what blocks us or what gets in the way of our being able to experience that equanimity comes from these three areas that we talked about last week, which is being disconnected or distracted in life, the hindrances, and this purification process of past actions, painful actions. So we're going to start with this idea of being disconnected. And last week we talked about it in relation to impermanence, that when we start seeing, or that equanimity helps us see when we're disconnected, so we can actually see that we're not connected to the natural impermanence that exists in the world. And I want to start with a poem by Kazuaki Tanahashi. His poem is entitled Encounter, and it's for Linda. He says, human to human, entering at this very moment, how rare, how precious. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. Let's start it again. Human to human, encountering at this very moment, how rare, how precious. Human to human, knowing each other at this very place, how rare, how precious. Human to human, loving each other in this very lifetime, how rare, how precious. Human to human, forming a family in this world, how rare, how precious. In a way, I think what he's pointing to is that no matter what we encounter in life, if we're not able to hold it as part of the stream of what we are dealing with, then we can get stuck in trying to make things a certain way. And everything about this moment in time is precious. Everything. And we can only really see that if we let life move as it moves. We talked about this last week. It's very difficult to do that when times are difficult, because the mind holds difficulty as permanent, holds it as solid. This is it. We have to fix it. It's a problem, and we can't really let it go. So we get stuck in this idea that whatever has happened, whatever is happening, is permanent. But I like Gil Fronstal's way of explaining equanimity as standing in the middle of it all. And that's sort of how we have to hold all these social justice issues that come up in our lives. It means that we have to stand in the middle of our own discomfort or our own difficulties with things that we hear and learn. We have to stand in the middle of that and know that it will pass. And the weird thing is, we're not trying to stand in the middle of something and know that the situation will pass. We're trying to stand in the middle of it and know that our overwhelm will pass. That's what's passing. The situation itself may take a long time and we have to do some efforts in it, but what we are aimed at as practitioners is to first let our overwhelm pass. Let it be. Let it let it rise and fall as all emotions do. So I thought about a few things. I want to give you some examples. So the first example I want to kind of throw out here is when I first started working as a prosecutor, I had a lot of judgment about me being a social activist as a prosecutor. I'm dealing with a lot of what I considered at the time bad people, and I'm doing the right thing for all beings and the right thing for society. And even though many of my friends and a lot of my family thought I was on the enemy side, what it was just the idea that I would go into the prosecutor's office and not be a defense attorney in criminal law made for some difficult conversations at Thanksgiving dinners. But I thought I was doing, I was championing the right, doing the right thing. And much of the pain that I felt, and I felt a lot of it, came from victims of crime. Victims who had to experience criminal behavior. I want to share a story about one. I'm going to share you three stories that are intertwined in this idea of criminal justice. So how are you going to work with criminal justice? And I want to show it to you from three different perspectives. So the first perspective, it's from somebody who was robbed. Some guy and his son who live in a small town in Missouri or Kansas, I can't remember. But anyway, they're from a very small town. They came to see the Kansas City Chiefs play in this football game. Big game, whatever that. Could have been just a regular game, but it's a big game. So they traveled all the way to Kansas City to see this game. And they had never been to Kansas City, and they had never been to a big city. So they, after the game, they, I think the son was maybe 14, and they decided that they were going to catch the bus back to their hotel. So they walked up a few blocks to this bus stop to catch the bus back to their hotel. And this black kid, these guys were white. The man was white. His son was white. This black kid was like, I don't know, 17, I think he was 18. He had just turned 18. He comes to this bus stop, and without any weapon, no gun, no nothing, he goes up behind this guy, puts his finger in his back, and said, "Give me all your money." And he scared the living daylights out of this man, who's thinking about his son. And the man lost it, began to beg for his life. He's scared to death, and he literally loses his lunch right there in front of everybody, his son, everybody. He's begging, crying. He lost it. The guy started laughing and walked away. Didn't want his wallet. He just was playing. He walks away. But he could have stayed away. But the reason why I, as a prosecutor, got that case is because he did not. They called the police. The guy looks around. He goes, "That's him right there." The police go get him. Now I have this guy, this kid, this man who has committed a heinous crime because of the taking, this attempted taking, with by force. And he had no gun, he had his finger, but it's by force. So he's charged with attempted robbery in the first degree. He got some juvenile stuff, but he don't have no bad stuff. The guy is, he goes home, he's panicked. When I talked to him in the, by the time I got this case, his son and him never had the same relationship that they had before that game. Somehow his son saw him as a weaker man. Like, why didn't you do something about this? Why did you act that way? So it completely severed, and he's so embarrassed, he can't hardly even talk to his son. Completely changed their relationship. I don't know how it is now, but it changed their relationship. So as a prosecutor, I want to offer this defendant a reduced sentence and a small amount of jail time. But the victim wants him to get a life sentence. Doesn't ever want him outside of prison again, because he could scare anybody. And so you're weighing, doesn't matter what happened in the case. What I want you to hear is, from that victim's perspective, social justice is a completely different understanding as to whether or not justice was going to happen. We offered this guy, the defendant, a plea deal. And this victim thought there was no justice in the world. No justice at all. But if I give you a different story, when I started working in prison as a prosecutor, I met a lot of defendants. They told me a lot about my own practice. I used to sit in a meditation group with a whole bunch of violent offenders in the prison, and they would meditate, and I mean, the room could get so still that I couldn't ring the bell. It was too quiet in there. And they taught me a lot about how to do time in the present moment. Things that I, even though I was a practitioner outside, I didn't know about that. I learned a lot about things that defendants never, I used to teach like nonviolent communication, and as I taught, I would learn these stories about what these men and women grew up, the worlds they grew up in. And I'll never forget this one inmate said, "I can't believe that I'm in my 50s and I'm learning something I should have learned when I was 10. It's like he had never, no one ever taught him how to articulate what he needed in the world. And so instead, he just would fight his way to get what he wanted. What do you do with that? I mean, he didn't learn it. That's a completely different perspective on social justice. So you're looking at him and you're thinking, oh my God, I really want to do something to help your life. I want to give you one more. I knew a cop who died in Seattle. And at his funeral, they had to move the venue. Usually when you go to a cop's funeral, there's a lot of people, but they're all pretty much cops and family and friends. But this particular cop, whose name was, he was a King County Sheriff, Officer Cox. When he died, they had to move his funeral, the venue of it, to accommodate the huge outpour of community people. He was a staunch conservative, serious Republican, and he and I did not agree on anything when it came to politics, not even a little bit. But he was as caring and connected and engaged in his community in White Center as I was. In fact, the way that he got shot is that he went into a building because there was a noise complaint, and he thought, this is just a simple noise complaint, but he didn't realize that the person that supposedly shot him had also shot someone else earlier. So that person thought he was there to arrest him, but he was there to deal with a noise complaint. And he didn't think it was that big, so he goes in the back with this kid, and he's just talking to him, and somehow or another, the kid shot himself, and Officer Cox got shot. At the funeral, these two sheriffs told the story about how they had set up this memorial for Officer Cox, and these two homeless-looking guys came up and want to know, what is all this? And they said, it's Officer Cox's memorial. You move on, you know, because they were like, go away. Don't be disrespecting our area here. And they were like, who's Officer Cox? They're like, he used to work this area. Go, you go on. They're like, I don't know no Officer Cox that used to work here. They wouldn't leave. And finally, he showed him the picture. And he's like, Superman? I cannot believe they called him Superman. I know he loved that. But Superman? You're saying Superman has been killed? And they're like, yes, he's been killed. And these two men burst into tears. And they were standing there crying, holding each other. And then the two sheriffs that were there, they started crying. Everybody's crying. They're standing here. And that's why they had to get this huge venue in order for all these community people to come to Officer Cox's funeral. The reason why I'm telling you these three perspectives is because if you're stuck in this permanent understanding that the police are bad, or the permanent understanding that defendants are bad, or the permanent understanding that victims are just, you know, want too much, then we don't ever deal with social justice. As practitioners, we got to stand in the middle of it all, which means that we have to understand there's going to be harm on all sides. And we are working with what I would say, whatever is in front of you at the time. So there's a way in which we have to be engaged with the world, engaged with criminal justice, without holding judgment around it, and instead work towards where there is harm in this moment in time, which means that we may have to let go of our future thinking about how we think the world should be, let go of our past experiences and what we learned about it and what somebody else said about it, and work more directly with whatever is happening. And it may mean that we have to stop living out of our opinions about social justice and actually get engaged in some area where we could see and experience all these different parts. Of course, if you're like me, you might find that you spend a lot of your time involving social justice in the opinionated judgment of it, the arguing of it, the conversations and the back and forth and the emotional upheaval that comes when you read the paper and learn about things. And I think a lot of that points to the disconnect that comes from the hindrances, which is what we have to practice with. I want to read a poem from an inmate. This inmate gave me this poem one time. This is the only time I've ever read this poem, because it's a little rough, but anyway, it's called The Cold Within, and it's some unknown author. I don't know where he got the poem from. It says, six humans trapped by happenstance, one black, in black and bitter cold. Each one possessed a stick of wood, or so the story's told. Their dying fire in need of logs, the first woman held hers back. For on the faces around the fire, she noticed one was black. The next man looking across the way saw one not of his church and couldn't bring himself to give the fire his stick of birch. The third man sat in tattered clothes. He gave his coat a hitch. Why should his log be put to use to warm the idle rich? The rich man just sat back and thought of the wealth he had in store, and how to keep what he had earned from the lazy poor. The black man's face bespoke revenge as the fire passed from his sight, for all he saw in his stick of wood was a chance to spite the white. And the last man of this forlorn group did not accept for gain. Giving only to those who gave was how he played the game. The logs held tight in death's still hands was proof of human sin. They did not die from the cold without. They died from the cold within. I never thought I'd ever have a time to read that poem, but I thought it was so perfect, because that is what I think the hindrances do to us. The hindrances create, if we don't practice with them and we treat the hindrance as if the hindrance itself is the truth about the moment, then we can get caught in our desire for something to happen, or in our aversion for the way things are, or in our just sloth and torpor because we're overwhelmed, or restlessness because of all the worry and concern about what's going to happen, and just the doubt of whether or not things will ever get better. These hindrances can suck the very life out of our efforts if we let the hindrances be sort of our light or our torch in how we deal with the social ills of the world today. Instead, I think that what equanimity kind of helps us do is to be more connected with the, with the moment itself. So everything that we deal with, even the ills of the world, is held in practice. There is something about it. I don't want to share another story about how I think we can hold it. I read an article one time about a guy, this would have been maybe 10 years ago, a guy who was convicted of a domestic terrorism. And what he did was he went around and he was an environmentalist, a tree hugger, they'd be called. And he would go around and make it difficult for loggers. And if you created some new development, housing development in woodsy areas, he and his crew would burn those houses down. So they burned down houses and they really created havoc for loggers to be able to log. But what drove me about this story, it was written by one of his supporters or friends or someone that knew him well, and he wrote a story about this guy's life. And this guy had never killed anyone. So no one had ever died in any of the actions he had done. And the author talked about his beliefs and who he was and how much he cared for trees and how much he cared about the forest in a way that I had never thought about environmental issues like this. The amount that this man was willing to go through in order to save trees. The length of time he would sleep in trees and sleep in forests in order to keep those forests from being clear cut. I have never done anything like that for trees, ever. But he would risk everything. He didn't have any money. No, nothing was of a value to him other than trees. And so he would risk everything in order to save a section of trees. It was a long article that ended with this guy getting something like 300 years in prison. And he not being able to ever talk to any of the friends he had contact with before, because he's convicted of a terrorism crime. And he's probably sent to a supermax where there's no access to outside and trees. It hit me with such a blow that now, every time I go around areas where there's lots of trees, I tell a few of them the story about this guy and how much he cared about trees and how much work he did for trees. And I ask them to pass it on in the underground so everybody knows what he did for trees. But I can't help that situation of that guy's life. And reading that article, I felt so much pain and sadness that the only thing I could think of doing was sharing his story over and over and over and over and over, over and over and over and over and over. And sometimes in some of the things that we have to deal with, that's all we get to do is share the story of some pain that we had, but not as more added pain. I don't share his pain of being put in prison in a supermax. I certainly don't think of him as a domestic terrorism. You could ask me about what I think is domestic terrorism. He would not be on that list. But when I talk to the trees, I don't talk about it like he is some terrible person. I talk about it with this uplifting love that he once was able to do on behalf of all trees and how I cannot do that. But I can share the story and you can tell. You can send it through the underground. It's because when some things, some levels of injustice that are in the world, we cannot fix. The injustice itself has already happened. But somehow, we have to begin to think in terms of underground railroads and the little systems that people use to hide the Jewish people in and out of Germany and Europe. There's a way in which, in the midst of great harm, is great kindness and great support. And if we stay up in the harm area, we miss this deeper underground level of change that's actually happening all over the place, simply because people are willing to risk whatever it takes. And if you cannot, let's say, family responsibilities, work responsibilities, just the fact that I have kids and I'm too scared of the dark, I cannot sleep in trees on behalf of trees, but I can still participate in this awareness of this underground level of kindness that we can share. I want to share one other story. This is from a book. I had to go get the name of this book. I don't know if you guys have read this book, but this has got to be, it's not a social justice book, but it is the best book. It's called In Love with the World. And maybe I'm a little slow and you guys already heard about this book, but it's called In Love with the World, A Monk's Journey Through the Bardos of Living and Dying. Who hasn't heard about that book? Oh, great. This is probably, it's by, I think his name is Yangi Mingyur Rinpoche. He's this famous Rinpoche abbot, and he wanted to do a 3-year retreat, which is normal in Tibetan practice to do a 3-year retreat, but you usually do it at a monastery. And he wanted to do his 3-year retreat in the world. But in order for him to do this 3-year retreat, because he's so famous and he's so, I can't remember the word that they say, but he's renowned. So he's like, very precious. He has had an attendant with him his entire life. He's always been cared for, like his holiness has always been cared for. So in order for him to do his retreat, he has to sneak out and he can't tell anyone that he's leaving. And the person that told him to do this is his father. Said, okay, when you get ready to do it, you got to sneak out. Can't tell nobody, not even your mama. You got to sneak out and then you're on your own. So he had it all planned. He snuck out. But what I want to share is one little piece. I don't have the words that he said, but he described being on a train and he decided that he was going to ride coach in his journey out of the, away from the monastery. So we're talking about a man that people don't even touch. He is so revered and so protected that he does not have to do anything, want for anything, and no one touches him. So he is on a train in coach, and this is Indian level, India level coach. So there's animals on there and people, and he describes this level of rage that keeps happening because people are bumping into him, falling into him. They don't even care about him. They don't know who he is. He's taking up space. They scram up against him. And he is having a freak out about, he is enraged. He's scared to death. He wants anything other than to be in that train. And he exquisitely describes how he practices with it. So it's the thing that I'm pointing to is that he isn't describing what you would think of as a Rinpoche who's like in love with all beings. And the Tibetans love all beings. So he has been drilled of compassion and love all beings. And I care about everybody. I know he has had students come in and he has shared love, 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 love. And here he is face to face with people he judge as nasty, dirty, lice-infected. These are his words. There's no way he wants to be in the world with them. And yet, he is trying to practice with this understanding. So he writes with such clarity around how do we deal when our minds are overwhelmed with the world and we need to also practice. So even though his book is not a social justice book, he writes about the kinds of energy I think the hindrances bring us when we deal with social justice. So I would strongly advocate looking at that book. The last thing has to do with our past actions. And I'll be quick so we have time. You can tell I get so caught up in this. Can't help it. It has to do with the reality that we are living in a world where we're practicing altruistic things, and at the same time, we are seeing just how limited human existence is. If you don't think that there'll be injustice for all human existence, then we need to talk about history, because I don't know a period in history where there has not been injustice. I don't know how we could not have injustice. Just if I look at my own life, I have caused a lot of harm to a lot of people when I didn't even know I was causing harm. So the idea that we can somehow move past to a perfect world can't be what we're practicing for. It has got to be more aimed at being with this imperfect world and not so much running from it. I remember Sims used to do, we used to serve meals at St. James as part of one of our social justice action pieces. And I remember the first time I went in to serve, there were so many people and it didn't seem like there was enough food. I kept giving just small amounts and people would say, can I have some more? And I would be like, dude, do you see all these people? A little bit more, just a little. And they would say, no, I want a lot more. And I was having a lot of overwhelm about greedy. You're too greedy. You have enough. Come back within seconds if we have enough. But I was having a lot of problems. And I think one of the workers must have saw me because he came over and stood by me like he was standing right here. He's looking out this way, not at me, and says, Tuari, we have plenty. There's a lot in the back and you don't have to worry. You give people as much as they want. But he never actually looked at me like he was scolding me. It was like he was accompanying me in this pain. Together, he was standing there with me, looking at this person saying, yeah, we have plenty of food. You can give them as much as they want. And then when they come back, there'll be seconds. You know, there was this sense of you're not doing anything wrong, but together we can do it. So I began to give people as much as they wanted. Oh, man. Talk about freeing. Just the idea that I could give as much as people wanted, and there was this long line of people, that in and of itself helped me understand hunger. some of the heaviness of homelessness can be stripped away if you just work with homeless people and be in the world with them and share in that joy and not just the heaviness of the world they live in. So everything we're doing is held within this Eightfold Path. And I want to leave us with one last story, kind of show you, because ultimately we have to begin to talk to people and be in worlds that we are not used to being in. We got to be in these worlds with people who don't even have the same view and begin to understand what's going on. So my mother used to listen to Fox News, and every time you went to her house, she had Fox News on and it was blasting. And I would try to figure out a way to turn off the TV or argue with her about why you watch all that. And so finally one day I'm like, Mama, why do you watch this? You know, these people don't even like you. So why do you watch it? She said, I watch, what did she call it? She watches Fox News because Fox News is what was on TV when she moved to Seattle some hundreds of years ago. And it was the only show that she could get because she didn't have cable. So she had to use an antenna, and the only news show that came in clear was Fox News. So she has been watching Fox News because it's Fox News as a habit for some 35 years. I said, don't you listen to what they say? She goes, oh, some of that stuff doesn't make any sense. I don't listen to that. But it's news. So that's her news show. And that's what she would not. I tried to give her another channel and she thought, that's not news. This is news. But the point I'm pointing to is, I don't know if my mother necessarily saw Fox News the way I saw Fox News. I think she just, that's the news that she's used to listening to. And I realized that I listen to news from stations I listen to all the time. And if I tried to listen to another station, it's like, that's not news. I gotta listen to my news, right? Oftentimes, the relationships we have with people, it's all habit. It's not me. It's not you. It's not what it is. We're living out of habit. And everybody's doing the habit that they're used to doing, thinking that that habit is the right way. It feels right. That's what habits do. So I'm going to leave you with one poem. This is attributed to, it's not even a poem, it's a saying, I guess. It's attributed to a Hopi Native American elder. And supposedly he gave this statement in April 1993. So I kind of checked it out to see what it is. I think it was a conference, and at some point in the conference, he kind of ended with this. You've been telling the people that this is the 11th hour. Now you must go back and tell the people that this is the hour. And there are things we need to consider. Where are you living? What are you doing? What are your relationships? Are you in right relation? Where is your water? Do you know your garden? It is time to speak your truth. Create your community. Be good to one another. And do not look outside yourself for the leader. Then he clasped his hands together, smiled, and said, "To my fellow swimmers, there is a river flowing very fast. It is so great and swift that there are those who will be afraid. They will try to hold on to the shore. They will feel that they are being torn apart and will suffer greatly. Know the river has its destination. The elders say we must let go of the shore, push off into the middle of the river, keep our eyes open and our head above water. And I say, see who is in there with you and celebrate. For in this time in history, we are to take nothing personally, least of all ourselves. For the moment we do, our spiritual growth and journey comes to a halt. The time of the lone wolf is over. Gather yourselves. Banish the word struggle from your attitude and your vocabulary. All that we do now must be done in a sacred manner and in celebration. For we are the ones we have been waiting for." So let's take a moment. This was not supposed to be a talk night, but I have talked through our time. So I'm hoping that you have the courage to talk about social justice in the larger group instead of getting in the smaller groups. We still have time to talk, but I don't think we have time to get into small groups. So I'm going to give you some three questions that I would have given in small groups. And I want you to take a moment to think about it and then maybe just share your comments in the context of this larger group. Rather than in a smaller group. So the first one is to consider, which kind of person are you? Are you all practice? Are you all activist? Or are you somewhere in both? You can share comments about that if you think that is something that you want to share a comment about. Or you could share a comment about your relationship between practice and social justice itself, where you have a difficulty or how you practice with it. And that would be the last one. It's like if you think of something that you find challenging in social justice, and how do you think your practice can support you? So I thought we could share whatever comments you have about social justice, and those are just three kind of ways to get us started. But I really just want to hear how you are with practicing. Are you even able to practice and still stay connected to a world in social justice? Oh, yeah.
So I came to practice with a value to be useful that is of a long time from when I was a child. And motivations.
Yeah. Yeah.
That sort of, that wanting to give genuinely, yet wanting something out of it.
Yes.
And in a situation where giving, and nothing gets coming back, and it's exhausting.
Yes.
So that balance. And I one of the things that you were speaking about struck me. I feel much more equanimity in working with men. Stay and talk with them and visit
with them,
not just me, but when I take food to the women's shelter, I'm like in and out.
Yeah.
It just hits me. I just, my skin's crawling and I'm just ready to. And that's not me.
Right.
But when I go into this shelter, it just hits me so. And I've never gotten to the place where I can feel
honest with that. Well, so let me just share for the video, the comment is that they work a lot with homeless men and women as part of their job and through their church. And, just it's always been a part of your life and this wanting to give. And you can practice with noticing when you want to be thanked and when you're leaning too much into it. Maybe expecting too much. When you get in overload, you can practice with all of that and kind of hold that with equanimity. But when it comes to going into the women's shelter, you can't hold that. Why, what is it that you think is keeping you from being able to do it in the women's shelter? Why does your skin crawl when you go there? To the women.
Well,
oh no, you feel. Oh. Oh, I see, I see. Right. That's right. Feels close to home. Yeah. 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 So the difficulty, I guess, would be then is because you can commiserate with and feel so closely connected to the women that it makes it difficult. If I think about what Rinpoche said in his book, In Love with the World, the pain of it is not the problem. It is that it is almost as if it's understandable because you can see how closely that could be you. The practice is really just creating space so that you actually touch into this. So it's not, can you go there or commit to being around there and being with the overwhelm as much as it is when you get back in your car and you're getting ready to drive after you've dropped off the food. Can you take a moment to either send metta, do metta, hold that feeling right then so that you don't let the moment itself pass right by? I get the sense when he was in the train and when he talks about through the book, he doesn't let the moments go by. He never seems to judge himself because he has all this judgment. Instead, he doesn't let the moment go by that he doesn't recognize the judgment itself. And then, oh, that's to be practiced with. So it's not, can you make yourself participate more with the women? You can accept that this is just the way it is right with you here now, right? But can you still practice by having compassion for that moment so that you don't ignore the moment or punish yourself because of that moment? Do you see? It's more of holding it as, oh, this is difficult for me. So I'll send metta to me. I'll send metta to the women. And then we'll move on. But I have a feeling, as I have read through the book, that all of a sudden that metta begins to help you in this deeper way. And when he described this train ride, part of his ability to stay on the train was because he kept practicing with deep hatred and fear and desire and all of that. Rage. He didn't know that he was going to be so angry that people touched him, but people kept bumping into him and he kept talking about how nobody knows who I am. Do you know who I am? Nobody even cared. They're like, who are you? Get out the way. You're taking up too much space with your little bag and stuff. Anyway, good. Yeah. Back here, Steve. Yeah.
You know, they had this enormous equanimity in the middle of opposing forces, and that's why they're all like the world, is to be able to just stay present with it in the deepest way.
Yeah.
Keep growing in the middle of the opposition and show up. And that's, and have compassion towards your oppressors, but also push back.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the comments that he sees himself as both a practitioner and the activist, and have really gotten involved with a lot of, I didn't know about the tear gassing and all of that. So it's pretty good there, Steve. It's like, I just, you know, have my protest, get my Starbucks and go others. Just say it. So pretty impressed. But, part of what keeps us inspired is knowing that all these leaders that we put a lot of faith in, and we've seen a lot with Gandhi and Martin Luther King and His Holiness, all these people who do great things in holding, large movements, they hold it with equanimity. And that's what enables us to really stay connected to them, is because they're holding both the difficulty with a balanced mind, but that they push back, that they don't just give in and cave into whatever's happening, that they do hold it with, that they do a level of pushing back, which causes some, there's a resistance that has to happen. I do think that in our lives, if we're not actually involved, we really have to take stock of how much we're actually engaged in social justice issues and how much we are engaged in the conversations around social justice. That's what some of the difficulty is. Because if you're not actually engaged, like you're pointing towards, then it is all talk. It's all opinion, and it's not really true in the world. We have opinions about it, but in most cases, and many people I know, they have very strong opinions about social justice, but then when you ask them, what do they do in terms of getting involved? They don't. And there is something to be said about getting involved and then beginning to experience, what is it like when I get involved? There's a different view from the involved world versus the opinionated world around some of these issues. A very different view. And being involved, it takes a lot. And you can see where your limitations are. And so holding everything in equanimity becomes the only way you can do it. Good. Want to go?
can't do anything about changing people's hearts and minds.
Right.
That could maybe change this whole process and make it different and more compassionate. But I'm reminded, too, that Brian Stevenson in Just Mercy said you have to be willing to be there with uncomfortable things. And so it's been good to be reminded of
that. That's right. That's right. And you know, the comment is that they do a lot of work in a food bank and serving, volunteering there. And then the scene, the 300 people coming every day, day after day, day after day. And you can't always change the system in which we are working in. But there's something about the practice that helps us be with difficulty. There's something about being with difficulty that teaches us something about human existence, about the mind, understanding the mind, understanding what's happening. The thing that I also think that we don't always give ourselves credit for is that being there in that moment, it changes people's lives. It doesn't seem like it because it's hundreds and hundreds of people. But having lived a long time on welfare and having lived as a single parent, gone to food banks and shelters and all kinds of crazy things, I still remember many of the people's faces that helped me. You just don't forget that. But if you've never had to take food from someone at a food bank or food from somebody who's handing it out at a kitchen, then you don't know the difference between somebody who smiles at you and someone who is barely seeing you. But I can't tell you how many homeless people, if I go past them and say, "I'm sorry, I don't have any money," they'll say, "Well, no problem. Thanks for noticing." I mean, I can't tell you how many people say that. I mean, that's part of the Rinpoche's problem. He was upset because no one knew who he was. And he did it that way on purpose, but he was shocked at how upset he got about that. In some respects, if those of us who practice and do social work, social justice work, could just show up and be there, we can make such a difference in people's lives. I mean, I seriously can still see the faces of people that handed me food just because I know what I was feeling at the time. And mostly I'm disconnected with that. And the only thing in that moment that's real is the face looking back at me. And so sometimes that's all we can do. That's enough because it inspired me to keep going and not living, not staying in that world. Anybody else want to share anything? Yeah.
And so even though my practice says, well, you know, that's
Yeah. Yes, it is very much.
And so I've thought about that a lot. And I still get so enraged when I think about the situation. But when I try to look at those individuals, I try to remember that. And I try to meet them differently without pity. And I think it was His Holiness who the teaching was that He would look at that person or He would say to that person,
Why?
It was so uncaring. Like, well, you know, good luck, and there's always been homeless people.
I don't know. I don't know. Okay. Well, let me share something with you. Let me just say the comment was, going up on Capitol Hill to the Thursday night group and seeing all the homeless people, you feel all this, sadness or, it's difficult because we live in America and it's like one of the richest countries in the world. So why would we have homelessness? And trying to work with it, not from the near enemy, which is pity. That's not real compassion. It's a disconnect. And how do you work with it? But the thing I want to point to is, if you think your practice is supposed to get rid of your discontent with homelessness, then you're looking at the practice the wrong way. Because homelessness brings with it a sense of discontent. Even if you're actually working with homeless, there's going to be sadness around it. It can't not be. The idea of the practice is not to eliminate my unpleasant feelings. The idea of the practice is to practice with my unpleasant feelings. That's what the whole point of it is, to practice with your unpleasant feelings. So if you're having unpleasant feelings around the homelessness on the street, then you practice with the unpleasantness of that. It's like when the Rinpoche got on the train. I mean, I guess this book just struck me because I've never heard a Rinpoche talk about the level of judgment he had with such clarity. So the same way he has this clarity of practice, he has a clarity of how upset he is. And he is serious about it. But it's not like he somehow or another was able to transcend his fear and his anger and his hatred on this train. He never transcended that. Let me say that again. He never transcended that. He eventually got off the train because he came into the station, but there was never this transcending and now I love all the beings on the train. It never got there. But even though it never got there, he never stopped practicing with his anger, his fear, and his irritation about being touched. He never stopped practicing. There's something about flipping the view from trying to come to an end of our suffering to learning to be with our suffering, and the end is our being with it. What you're ending is the constantly trying to fix it. That's what you're ending. And then you're just in the first arrow, which is the suffering itself. But I never heard or read anyone articulate it quite that succinctly. The way he talked about it was, when he first got on the train, he was squished up against the door and he hated that. You're touching me, touching me, touching me. And he's like, you shouldn't be worried about it. You asked for this. But they're touching me. They're touching me. They shouldn't be touching me. So he's like juxtaposing these two. Then he finds a place on the floor. And now he says, oh, I'm tucked away. So, finally. Okay, I got some peace and relaxation away from all these people. And of course, the train keeps joking and jerking and they keep falling on him and stepping on him and they don't even say, I'm sorry. And he's getting even madder. And then he finds a seat on the bench and he thinks, okay, now I'm on the bench. My back, I'm finally part of the riding in coach. I'm on the bench, but he doesn't want any of these, what he calls lice infected people to be sitting around him and take your dirty kids and go somewhere. And he's just so upset. So he never gets to this altruistic, I love all beings. What he does is he doesn't stop practicing with the hindrances of desire and aversion and sloth and torpor and restlessness. He just keeps practicing with them. So he could have at any time got off that train and said, okay, yeah, this is not working for me. Call the monastery and say, can somebody come get me? Cause I'm done with this. I'm clear. I'm try something else. I'm going in the cave or something. I'm not doing this. And he thought about it. I could call home. But he just keeps practicing with it. It's painful. It's difficult. It doesn't diminish. He just keeps practicing. So you do what you can when you see these difficulties, but ultimately, you're not practicing to eliminate my sense of difficulty. We're practicing in order to be able to be with our sense of difficulty. See the difference? All righty. Well, we only have about 4 minutes left. And it's probably time to head out. I hope that I have encouraged you to use your practice as part of social justice. You're not trying to fix anything, but you are trying to be engaged with it. You are trying to be engaged with the world. And we really need to be engaged with the world over the next year. So there's a sense that we may not be able to do what other people can do. We may not be able to, you know, keep it all together. But I know we can do something. So I'm going to leave us with this little thing about geese. It's called the goose story. Next fall, when you see geese heading south for the winter, flying along in the V formation, you might consider what science has discovered as to why they fly that way. As each bird flaps its wings, it creates an uplift for the bird immediately following. By flying in V formation, the whole flock adds at least 71% greater flying range than if each bird flew on its own. When a goose falls out of formation, it suddenly feels the drag and resistance of trying to go it alone and quickly gets back into formation to take advantage of the uplifting power of the bird in front. When the head goose gets tired, it rotates back in the wings and another goose flies point. Geese honk from behind to encourage those up front to keep up their speed. And finally, and this is important, when a goose gets sick or is wounded by gunshots and falls out of formation, two other geese fall out that with that goose and follow it down to lend help and protection. They stay with the fallen goose until it is able to fly or until it dies. Only then do they launch out on their own or with another formation to catch up with their group. That's from Dr. Harry Clark. Anyway, it ends with, if we had the sense of a goose, we would stand by each other, just like that. So, thank you very much. I think Jerry is going to be here next week. I'm going to Spirit Rock to teach on the New Year's Eve retreat, and I think it's Jerry that's going to come next week and do a talk on I can't remember. I think it's around, excuse me?
The website
says it's Jerry. Yes, it's part of equanimity, but how to just hold it all together in our lives is what I think it's going to be. Alrighty, so thank you very much for your kind attention, and I'll see you when I come back for the Refuges and Precepts.